Welcome to Banfield. A Connecticut dad goes off on young employees at a smoothie shop, and the resulting video is racing around the internet faster than a blender on puree. 17-year-old Charlie Hill, an employee at the shop, posted it on TikTok, and a warning, some of you might find this offensive.
I have no room to yell at
him. I want to speak to the person who made this drink. Is that you?
No,
well,
it wasn't
me. We don't know who made it, so.
You don't know who made it?
There's four of us here, so we honestly don't know.
Fucking stupid ignorant high school kids.
Okay, bye.
I want to speak to the
bye. Okay, you can call corporate whenever you want. Goodbye.
Yeah, I'm stuck.
You're
I don't care.
Give it to me right now.
I'm calling the police. I'm calling the police.
I want the telephone.
Gianna,
I want the telephone. Shut the
This all happened on Saturday, and that man has now been identified as 48-year-old James Iannazzo of Fairfield, Connecticut. He left the store before the police arrived, but he eventually turned himself in. The court of public opinion has already rendered its verdict with an amplified guilty, but will an actual court see it the same way? Here's how the police described the event. At 1 p.m., Iannazzo made a purchase at this Robeck smoothie shop and left the store. Then, 40 minutes later, Iannazzo called 911 from his home asking for an ambulance because his son was having an allergic reaction. His son was transported to an area hospital. Police say a short time later, Iannazzo then returned to the Robex and confronted employees, which led to the video that you just saw. Iannazzo now faces three charges: intimidation based on bigotry or bias, breach of peace, and criminal trespass. He's also been fired from his job as wealth advisor with Merrill Lynch. I want to bring in Melissa Scheichel. She is a social worker and psychotherapist who has children with severe allergies. She also runs a very popular blog at the site allergymom.com. And April Prayer is a criminal defense attorney and adjunct professor at John Marshall Law School. Welcome to both of you. Okay, so first and foremost, Melissa, I want to begin with you. There's a lot of the story that not everybody knows. And when some people know it, they change their opinion. And when some people learn it, they don't. An employee says that he ordered a smoothie called Peanut Power Plus without nuts. But the employee says he did not inform anybody of an allergy. The father says he stressed that his son had an allergy. This was according to Charlie Hill, the employee. Quote, he just said no peanuts in it. But if you don't say you have a nut allergy, which is an option on the app and in person, we use different stuff if there's a nut allergy. So he didn't tell us he had an allergy. So clearly his son had a near lethal reaction to the nuts that, were in this drink. And clearly, the man made his way to the store from the hospital where his 17-year-old son had had that reaction. So Melissa, I want you to weigh in on it as a mother who not only has a child with a severe allergy like that, but also you sort of have this group, you run this blog of people who have dealt with this kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're dealing with food allergies, it's really your responsibility to advocate for your child. And that means, going above and beyond with notifying this is an allergy. This isn't just a preference. This is something that could be, in fact, life-threatening. It's anaphylaxis. And, I see the word on the screen there, Papa Bear. You get really protective when it's your child's health and safety, right? And so for me personally, would I be ordering that smoothie? I would not. We do have something similar where I live that's called a peanut butter. But my concern would still be whether or not other ingredients contained nuts or traces of nuts, or whether the machinery that they're using has had traces of nuts cross-contamination. So I was quite surprised that he did order that and not be more explicit from the version, of course, of the story that I'm hearing.
Okay, so April, I want to get you to weigh in with your legal eye, because I'm sure that you were sort of looking at it from a whole bunch of different perspectives. A, it's ugly no matter what, no matter how angry, no matter how, you know, devastated you are that your son nearly died. You can't go into a store where it's a bunch of high school kids and start screaming profanities, scaring them, and then calling one of those kids an immigrant loser. But now the charges, you heard me list them off. Are those fair?
Are they fair charges? They, his actions are disturbing, and they seem to fit the charges. So the highest charge is the intimidation based on bias. And that bias can be race, it can be sexual orientation, it can be gender identity, et cetera. And it seems as though when he indicated that he believed the young woman to be an immigrant, and he also, it was bleeped out of the video, used the B word several times when he was referring to the young women, I think that would qualify for that charge. The problem with the charge is it carries 1 to 5 years in prison. Do I think he'll get that in any court? No. And up to a fine of $5,000. And it is a felony. The two other charges, the breach of peace and the criminal trespass, are both misdemeanors. If he was happened to be found guilty of the felony charge, those would get merged into the felony. So the biggest problem, I don't think, are his words. I think it's his actions. So not only does he throw the smoothie and actually make contact with the young woman's shoulder, but then after that, he tries to get into the back office or into the back area, and you hear him shaking the knob of the door like he's trying to get to them. And so it's his threatening actions in addition to the words that I think might have him in quite a bit of hot water. I'm not sure that any judge will actually find him guilty of a felony, but based on his actions, he may very well be guilty of the other two charges.
It's such a great and succinct rundown of all of it, because you nailed about 6 of my questions with one answer, which was perfect. And I kept thinking, I think she's talking about what might be also a plea bargain here. I mean, he has already been, you know, pretty, you know, forthcoming with his admissions of embarrassment and of guilt, and saying he was a father who was, you know, apoplectic at his son nearly dying. I also think there's an element, if you listen to the video without the beeps, you hear a lot more of what's going on. And it's almost as though the high school kids are goading him as well, saying, you know, bye-bye, 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 rather than, we're so sorry, sir. You know, let me get you a number. Let me help you. I mean, they definitely didn't act as though there was a manager on premises. But they're kids, right? These were 16, 17-year-old kids. And this is a big, angry guy, you know. And these kids probably don't understand, Melissa, what it's like when you've nearly lost your baby. Yes, he's 17. So to that end, he was a wealth manager, a wealth advisor at Merrill Lynch for 26 years. And Forbes actually named him one of Connecticut's 25 best wealth advisors just last year. So this is what that, you know, Merrill Lynch came out with before any investigation, before anything. They just fired him outright and said, our company does not tolerate behavior of this kind. We immediately investigated and have taken action. This individual is no longer employed at our firm. I mean, immediately investigated, man, it's only like 48 hours old. I don't know how much they could do. I don't know if they talked to him. I don't know what Merrill Lynch did, but I do want to ask you, Melissa, if you think that that's also fair, because basically this guy's life is over. First, he nearly loses his kid, freaks out and says something terrible, and now he's getting the death penalty without dying. Is this fair, you know, from your perspective?
Yeah, honestly, you know, when I first heard of the story, I read an article, so I hadn't actually seen the video, and I felt this compassion for this person, because as a psychotherapist and mental health professional, I also know, you know, what happens to our brain when we're under great duress. We go into, as you know, fight, flight, freeze, and submit. And this man, from all accounts, was clearly in fight. But afterwards, having watched the video, we are still ultimately responsible for how we handle that kind of stress and regulating our emotions. And I think, you know, this could have been handled so much better. And I'm sure if you film anyone in the most, you know, trauma traumatic moments of their life, they would look back and think, I wish I had handled it differently. And this was such an opportunity for education of that staff. I think, you know, food service in general doesn't always recognize the implications of allergies. And if he had asked for peanut, in fact, to not be in that smoothie, maybe having follow-up questions that they're trained to ask, is there an allergy? You know, what's the reason you're requesting that accommodation here? So, you know, such a learning opportunity for anyone on both sides of this, you know, in the food service as well as parents. Just a reminder that you do have to be that explicit and really stress, you know, how severe these allergies can be.
So, April, that brings me to, I think, what's a very important point here. This is, you know, this is a recklessness or a carelessness that could have been lethal. And these are 17-year-old kids who are at the wheel. They're at the wheel of the smoothies, right? What is the legal exposure here for that store, having left a bunch of minors in control of something that nearly killed a kid? Does this man, who's experiencing the worst 2 days of his life, have a big civil suit ahead against Robex that he could win despite his own behavior?
He may have a civil suit based on negligence, especially if it's, as you say, there was no adult on the premises. All I know is what I saw in the video, and they all appeared to be teenagers. And if there was nobody else supervising them, it will come down to their training. It will come down to, had the supervisor just left, was the supervisor in the back? So he may very well have a civil suit based on negligence. But I read a contradictory report saying that he actually did not tell the staff about an allergy. He simply said, as the kid said, no, I'd like no peanuts, please. So, you know, it's a matter of whether you put them on notice as well. That will be an issue when it comes down to a lawsuit based on negligence.
So it's, that's a good point. It was only one person, the 17-year-old girl named Charlie, who posted this video on TikTok, who said, he just said, I mean, it was kind of a mix up, and I'm not sure about the syntax in it. It was a little tricky to understand, but she actually said these words. Let me find them because it's important. Because I would think that you'd need, you know, witness corroboration when you separate the witnesses right away, because there's been 48 hours for these kids to all get together and get their story straight if they so want to do that. But he just said no peanuts in it. But if you don't say you have a nut allergy, which is an option on the app and in person, we use different stuff if there's a nut allergy. And I'm not, you know, I'm not saying that Charlie's not right, but I'm also saying that there's two sides of this story, and clearly they're both probably pretty dug in at this point. Both sides pretty angry at each other. It's not easy to be 17 and be attacked like that. And it's not easy to be 48 and nearly lose your son. So in that respect, just quickly, and I think, you know, April, you're the best person to answer this. If he does launch a civil suit, do you think the jury would be sympathetic to the kids and sympathetic to Robux, or sympathetic to him?
I think you'll have jurors who are sympathetic to both. I think you'll have jurors who will say this man was almost 50 years old. He needed to learn to control his emotions and not enter the store if he was that emotional. That's one. And then on the flip side, I think you will very much have parents on there who are saying, how dare you talk to this 48-year-old man this way, young lady? So I think that, you know, you'll have jurors. I mean, we're all human. And so we've all been right on both sides of that. And I think that's what the jurors will see. And they will say, hey, these kids don't know that your kid almost died. They just know that you entered the store angry.
He did say it. The first thing he said when he came in the store was, I've just come from the hospital and my son nearly died. So they knew that. But at 17, I don't think I had any appreciation for what that really felt like, certainly. And I think we could all agree on that. And thank you both, because I think this is just a really robust conversation. It shows exactly two sides of the story. And that's what we're all about at News Nation. Melissa, thank you. April, thank you. I hope you both come back.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good evening.
You too. All right. Our other top story tonight, it's a good one. An aggrieved ex, a pile of Bitcoin, a murder-for-hire site on the dark web. What could possibly go wrong? How about everything? Which is actually very lucky for the would-be victim, and not so much for the Florida woman who's now facing 10 years in the federal pen. Deanna Marie Stinson pleaded guilty to hiring a hitman, or trying at least to do so, to murder her romantic rival, her ex-boyfriend's spouse. The prosecutors say, and actually Stinson admits, that last summer she set up an account on a dark website that boasted, and I'll quote, "If you are looking to have someone murdered, beaten, kidnapped, you've arrived at the best place." The very next day, Stinson ordered, and again I quote, "a quick hit in southern Florida." And she provided the target's name, address, photo, and these instructions. Again, I quote, "Do not do at the home. Any place else is fine. Need completed during July, preferably between July 5th and 11th. Well, July 11th came and went and nothing happened. And so, you know, Natch Stinson reached out again and said this, "Need completed during July, bonus if completed by July 31st. So July 31st came and went, and Stinson grew tired of her romantic rival still being alive. She insisted the murder site, quote, "reassign the job to someone who has a history of getting jobs done." By this point, she had paid them more than $13,000 in Bitcoin, which she did not think could be traced back to her. Oh, but it could, and it was. And by the end of July, the FBI was on to her. An undercover agent posed as the contract killer that she was waiting for, and the rest you can probably imagine, right? Deanna Stinson was arrested at her Tampa home in September, which came as a big surprise to her neighbors, and even bigger surprise to her colleagues at the financial consulting firm that she founded 20 years ago. Incidentally, that firm is called Woe Consulting, for women of excellence, not woe is me. But the biggest shock of all may have been to Stinson's fellow worshipers at the Bible-based Fellowship Church. That's where she was financial director. And one more tidbit before I bring in my guest. The website that was Stinson's undoing, supposedly, you know, the best place to have someone murdered, beaten, kidnapped, it was a scam. Stinson ended up being the victim of a cybercrime on top of all of this. Okay, I am joined now by Jason G. Weiss. He's a retired FBI supervisory special agent and currently a cybersecurity attorney at the law firm of Fagery, Drinker, Biddle, and Reith. Jason G., it's good to have you back on the show. I actually don't even know where to start on this one, so I thought I'd just let you start. Go ahead.
Hi, Ashley. First of all, thank you for having me again. I really appreciate it. You know what I find super interesting about this case is if anybody is clever enough to figure out how to get onto the dark web, because you can't use the typical browser for that. You can't Google or, you know, edge your way onto the dark web. You have to use a special type of browser. It's not a task for the unsophisticated. Assuming she does get onto the dark web, generally people anonymize themselves on the dark web, and most legitimate dark websites want you to be anonymized because they don't want records of you for fear of law enforcement coming in and causing them trouble. So I'm not exactly sure where to go with this. You know, I actually asked myself, was this really on the dark web, or did she just Google a website looking for a hitman? Because it seems ridiculous that she would do all this and put it all in her own name, because that's not how most reasonably sophisticated criminals use cryptocurrency.
Now, how many reasonably sophisticated criminals have we all come in contact with? Because in my line of work, about 90% of them are not. I guess you do, yeah. Okay, so the other thing that struck us all at Banfield was the notion that Bitcoin is maybe traceable. Is it?
It's traceable. First of all, you got to understand, when cryptocurrency came out in 2013, there were maybe a handful at most different crypto type of currencies. There's now more than 7,800 cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin is just a type of cryptocurrency. You can certainly buy it. You can buy it at my mall, the local mall. There's a crypto machine where you can buy it. But generally, if you're going to buy or use cryptocurrency in an illegal fashion, and this happens in cybercrime all the time, I deal with it as part of my, you know, my law practice. When you're dealing with ransomware cases and cyber threat actors, they buy cryptocurrency anonymously, they move it through an encrypted wallet. They don't allow themselves to be traced or tracked, making it, I don't want to say impossible, but borderline impossible to figure out who their true identity is or how to trace the money. If done correctly, it's very difficult. I mean, this defendant really really must not have thought this one through if she actually registered the cryptocurrency in her own name, and then they were able to track that to a dark website. I mean, I really don't have an explanation for that other than this is how we catch unsophisticated criminals. I mean, there are a lot. Let me tell you, in the cyber world, there are a lot of folks that know how to use cryptocurrency, and it's very hard to track. And we give their information in case it's the law enforcement. And a lot of times, if they have encrypted wallets, you're just not going to get them. Most of them are not even in this country. They work outside the United States, where our ability, even when I was with the FBI, is somewhat limited because we don't have, you know, jurisdictional powers in countries outside of the United States for the most part.
Well, there are reasons that there are books written about the Darwin types that make it, with their different kinds of actions and crimes. I want to play for Absolutely. You one of her neighbors and the because, you know, I think among us all, there can be so many unsuspecting people that you would think would be capable of doing something like this. And I think she's one of them. You know, she's with the church and she lives in a nice neighborhood. And this is what one of her neighbors had to say. Take a look.
My neighbor texted me and said, I didn't want to call you at 6:30, but the feds, the FBI, and a bunch of unmarked cars are out in the yard. We're for hire. Wow. I am so glad I didn't piss her off as a neighbor.
I love that.
Yeah, that's rough.
I know. I'm also curious, though. I mean, look at a nice place. Like, she lives in a nice neighborhood. I'm curious about the scammers because, you know, clearly they wanted to steal money, but aren't they technically complicit now in a conspiracy? And can't the feds, if they can find them, go after them for conspiracy because they agreed to all of this and took money for it?
You know, that really falls under the purview of the U.S. Attorney's Office because somebody did the right thing and turned this person in. And a lot of times that buys you goodwill from a prosecutorial standpoint. I mean, I can think of one case I worked in particular where a hacker had broken into somebody's system and found that that person was manufacturing child pornography. The hacker got a stern talking to and was told never to do it again, but then was not prosecuted because the information they gave us was far more valuable and far more important. And when you live in that world of quid pro quo, I'm wondering if that wasn't the case here, is if this was a scam website and this information was obviously being viewed by members of the media. I mean, it was basically out in the open, which was shocking. It seems like while their crimes are bad, they pale somewhat in comparison to the fact of trying to kill another person. And I'm wondering if, you know, they're going to get some kind of prosecutorial benefit from it. I don't know because I'm obviously not part of that team. But generally, the government does prioritize who they want to, you know, because they might need their cooperation as well. And, you know, one point I just have to make is you bring up the church thing, and the only thing I'd point out is the BTK killer, Dennis Rader, was a pastor at a church. Yep. So being in a church does not make you immune from the wrong way of living.
No, you're right. And he was a local park ranger, and he was squeaky clean, and his family knew nothing. I hear you, Jason G. I really do. But I tell you, the FBI, it's like shooting fish in a barrel if they just troll that site. Thank you for being here, Jason G. Weiss. Nice to see you again.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here. It's good seeing you again, Ashley.
You too. Take care. Okay, still ahead tonight, all those emails that promise big money if you click on this link or call that number or go to that website. You know they're all scams, right? A week ago, we said so. And tonight, we're saying, oh, maybe there's an asterisk. A multi-million dollar exception to the rule when we come back. Welcome back. Right now, if you are like me, you have at least one email in your spam folder or maybe front and center in your inbox telling you how to claim fabulous cash and prizes, and you probably won't give it a second look. After all, we just had this conversation a few days ago with our friend from the FBI, Chris Swecker.
Most things that look too good to be true are too good to be true.
Wait a minute. Did you catch the first word that he actually said? Play it again.
Most things that look too good to be true are too good to be true.
Most things. Like 99.99999 repeating percent of things. Maybe. But there are exceptions, it turns out. Very, very, very rare exceptions. like this one. Laura Spears. She bought a Mega Millions ticket online on New Year's Eve. And then she promptly forgot about it. And on Friday, she was just browsing, you know, through her spam folder for an email from a friend. And instead, she found an email from the Michigan Lottery informing her that she'd won $3 million. Seen that one before. But Spears had actually matched 5 of the 6 balls, and her giant check was just waiting for her. And yes, they reached out to her via email for real. Jake Harris joins me now from the Michigan State Lottery. Jake, you emailed her. Did you ever think for a minute anybody would actually believe the email?
Well, thanks for having me tonight, Ashley. And, you know, this is something when you play Michigan Lottery online, you do get an email alert that you've won a prize. And some of those prizes go right into your wallet. You can deposit those into your bank account. But for $3 million, you get an alert that you need to come claim your prize in Lansing. And that's what Ms. Spears did.
So it's not one of those things where there's a big red button that says, click here and then give me all your personal information and we'll send you your money lickety split.
No, not at all. It's just a notification that you need to log into your lottery account, and they have a prize waiting for you. And then once you're in that account, we have a secure platform where you can go in. If we need documentation, we make sure we get that. And then the player starts the claim process online, and then that ends with us in Lansing handing over that big check that you see in the photo there.
Lucky Laura. Wow. And I'll say lucky twice, because if she weren't looking in the spam folder, she might have missed it. How long would she have had before, you know, looking in that spam folder, say next year, she'd have been out of luck?
Yeah. So the good news is that in Michigan, draw games give you 1 year from the date of the drawing to claim the prize. And that's what Mega Millions is. It's a draw game. And then, you know, even if she hadn't seen the email when she logged into her lottery account, she would have gotten a notification at that point. So it's very likely she would have claimed the prize. And, you know, we hate seeing prizes go unclaimed. We love paying winners and having great stories like this.
Do many of them actually go unclaimed because maybe they did go into spam and people didn't know?
You know, I can tell you that for most prizes online, they're going to be smaller prizes. They're going to go automatically into your account. You don't actually have to go through that claims process. When we're talking about a prize of more than $100,000, that's where that comes into play. It's pretty rare that those go unclaimed. You know, last year, players in Michigan won $3 billion. And just a fraction of that goes unclaimed each year. So most of those prizes are being sent home with folks and put to good use.
Okay, other than the message to people out there, hey, put your Michigan Lottery in your contacts or whatever state you might be in with the Mega. What other advice do you have for people out there to make sure that they get the message when they win?
Well, you know, I think the thing first and foremost on this one is to remind people that, you know, you can't win a lottery prize if you didn't play a lottery game. And we hear from people all the time who say, well, I got this email or I got this phone call saying that I won a prize, but I didn't buy a ticket. And, you know, the answer there is, well, then you can't have won a prize. So, you know, number one, you've got to buy a ticket to win. And if you didn't do that, then it is a scam. And, you know, in this case, just keep an eye on your spam folder. It may go in there, but we also have a lot of players who get those emails into their inbox, no problem. This one just seems to be a little bit of an outlier, and it's kind of a fun story, I think, because of the amount.
Yeah, I mean, seriously. And listen, I should just mention there's 9 states plus D.C. that have online sales, and Mega Millions is played in 45 states. So I hope a lot of people see this and take note. If you play, check your email and check your spam filter, too. By the way, can I just say, Jake Harris, you have impeccable virtual background game going on tonight.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm glad that I get to put it to use. You know, this is something fun to talk about. And we love, like I said, paying players big prizes. And we have a lot of great winners in Michigan, and this is just one of those stories.
Well, let's hope you have some in Connecticut and New York soon, too, just saying. Jake, thanks so much. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too. Okay, folks, Super Bowl just weeks away, but the LA Rams are already running a robust defensive play against the crowds. Find out just how much home field advantage means to them and the length they are going to keep it. And welcome back to Banfield, everybody. Doritos, check. Budweiser, check. Hot dogs, nachos, and chili, check. tickets to the Rams game this weekend. Fat chance if you're a 49ers fan. The Rams have decided if you ain't from around here, you're not welcome. Back on January 9th, it seems they were overrun by a sea of red San Francisco fans who packed SoFi Stadium. And this time, the Rams say they hope home field advantage stays home field advantage. So they decided to block ticket sales to anyone whose credit card billing address falls outside of L.A. proper. Here is the message that fans received when trying to purchase tickets from outside of the preferred zone. Public sales to the game at SoFi Stadium in Inglewood, California, will be restricted to residents of the greater Los Angeles region. Residency will be based on credit card billing address at checkout. Orders by residents outside of the greater Los Angeles region will be canceled without notice and refunds given. I think the syntax there is that you will get the refunds, not without refunds given. Nonetheless, forget about it if you were outside the zone. So once the stadium was sold out, the policy magically disappeared. So now really the only way of getting 49ers tickets, if you're a 49ers fan and you want to go and see the Rams, is with a third-party ticket, if you can find one and afford one. So this got us thinking, not so much about that strategy. It's probably a good one. It's really about how much of an advantage is home field advantage? Here to break it all down is Bram Weinstein. He is the play-by-play voice of the Washington football team. He's also the former host of ESPN's SportsCenter. Bram, I have always wondered how measurable, you know, I know there's something to the zeitgeist, right? You hear everybody screaming and it's fun and all your fans are there, but tangibly, is there any proof that there's something to home field advantage?
I'd love to ask a band if playing in front of the crowd makes them play better, or the how loud the crowd can be makes them play better. I don't know. Metrically, it exists, yes. Like, more teams at home win than they lose. However, if you really wanted to deep dive into home field advantage, go look at the teams with the really good quarterbacks who go really far and go check their home records and then go check everyone else's. Like, this year in the NFC with Tampa Bay, Green Bay, Dallas, Arizona, Philadelphia, those teams that made the playoffs, only five of the 16 teams had a better record at home than they did on the road. So what does that tell you? I mean, I think we're in a very different time in the NFL. There's a tremendous amount of parity in the league. The rosters are very close to one another. There's limits. There's salary caps. And if you don't have one of those really, really great quarterbacks, winning and losing is a very week-to-week thing in the NFL.
It's interesting. I do see this stat from 538.com that over 57% of games are won by home teams. And I think that's interesting. But then I was super interested when one of our producers named Will Budkins, who knows everything there is to know about football, told me about the silent count. And I said, what's the silent count? And I read about it. And here is something that a professor who studies this, he's from the University of Pittsburgh, wrote, and it appeared on PBS. I want to read it. It says, the common perception is that a loud crowd will make it more difficult for visiting players to hear the play that's called. And this will lead to confusion and delayed reactions from the players. But if crowd noise really did have this effect, you'd expect more false start penalties to be called on the visiting team. This does not happen. So if it's not crowd noise that, you know, makes the silent count and the different signals they have to use a disadvantage, what is it that causes the 57% advantage at home field?
I don't know that we have an answer to it. I would go back to the better teams win more often than the bad teams, no matter where the game is played. And often it's not necessarily about who you play or where you play, it's when you play them. What state is their roster in? Have you had more rest than them? Are you healthier than they are? And that often matters more than where the game actually takes place. This is not to dismiss the idea of home field advantage. I mean, for all of us who are in sports, anyone who likes live events, they're incredible scenes, and there's nothing like being part of that crowd and rooting for your team or rooting against that team and going into as a road crowd and a road fan. So I think, listen, sports brings people together. You know, does this metrically exist? I don't know. You know, tangibly, does it exist? In college football, it probably does. In other sports like the NBA, you'll see a far bigger disparity between the good teams and the bad teams, especially with a home record. But in the NFL, where the parity really, really rises to a specific level, I don't think you're going to see much of a difference between wins and losses. And just take this past weekend. Three of the four home teams lost, including the two teams that had the best records in their respective conferences. And the other one, there was five miracles that occurred in a matter of 2 minutes. And one of them had to win and one of them had to lose. And it very easily could have been the home team. They could have been 4-for-4.
Yeah, I always thought if, you know, I came from Winnipeg, and I thought if any team comes to play in Winnipeg in February, they're going to lose because they don't know what it's like to do everything there in that kind of temperature. But that's not always the case. Hey, Bram, nice to meet you. Will you come back sometime?
Yeah, happy to. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. Okay, coming up, quitting work and sailing into the sunset. That's kind of everybody's dream, right? But where should you really do that? A new study has just revealed the five best and worst places to spend your golden years. Is it worth the move? And is it worth visiting the person who moves there? We're going to divulge all next. Garden State of New Jersey came in 50th place, dead last, on the 2020 list of best states to retire. So if New Jersey is at the bottom, that's got to mean there's a whole lot of stuff up top, right? Joining us with the good, the bad, and the ugly is financial analyst Jill Gonzalez from Wallet Hub, who ran the study. Jill, thank you for being here. First of all, I want to put up the last of the five states, the worst five states, because like I'm trying to figure out what binds these states together. 46th place is Oklahoma. 47th is Kentucky. 48th is New York. 49th is Mississippi, and 50th, of course, is New Jersey. What are the metrics that you're using there? Because I can see differences in all of those places.
Yeah, we actually looked at 47 different indicators of retirement friendliness. So as you can see, it's not necessarily regionally based or weather based, although that was certainly a factor. But we looked at really affordability, not only taxpayer friendliness, but retiree taxpayer friendliness. Are they taxing pensions, Social Security, et cetera? And just overall quality of life, everything from healthcare to how many golf courses there are per capita.
Oh, I like that. All right. So the best ones, because I know we always want to be positive, too. And I want to retire like the people in these pictures, by the way. The best ones are in fifth place, Minnesota. Holy Dinah, that's cold. Fourth is Delaware. Third is Colorado. Second is Virginia, and a number one is Florida. Can you tell me about Minnesota? Because I would think that'd be kind of tricky for older folks.
Yeah, it's not as cold as Winnipeg, but it's certainly close. But the healthcare system is so great there, right? I mean, you have the Mayo Clinic that's right there and everything that really stems from it. It's a very, very good healthcare system. Even things like in-home services and adult day healthcare, you know, really thinking further down the line. Those things are not only very cost effective in Minnesota, but it's really top notch quality.
And listen, ice fishing is awesome. I can tell you right now, I love it. Okay, but what about Delaware? What's the deal with Delaware? What makes it great?
Delaware also has great quality of life. There are a lot of beach towns there that kind of skew older, and you really can't beat the tax situation there. I mean, save for Florida, but taxes are very low. Property in general is low to begin with. So you're looking at, again, very cost-effective way of life moving forward.
And, you know, when it comes to weather, I look at Florida all the time and I think, well, what about, you know, Hawaii and Southern California? But I guess they're pretty expensive and Florida's got a lot of deals. So that makes perfect sense that Florida's right up there. Hey, Jill Gonzalez, thank you for doing the study and thank you for sharing it with us.
Anytime.
Great to have you on. Okay. All right. So with all its retirees, you might think that Florida has the oldest population of any state, but it's number two. So place your bets. What state has the highest percentage of people over the age of 65? Answer. Okay. So, what do you think? Which of the 50 states has the highest percentage of seniors, people over the age of 65? It ain't Florida. The good people at the Population Reference Bureau crunched the numbers for us, and boom, Maine, baby. Almost a quarter of the population there, 21.8% of Mainers are in their golden years. It's followed by Florida and West Virginia, Vermont, and Delaware. So if you're wondering what state has the fewest seniors, it's Utah, with only 11.7% of its population over the age of 65. And after Utah, it's Alaska, Texas, Georgia, and Colorado. And that is it for us tonight. I was going to say goodnight, but if you're in Maine, you might already be asleep. Oh, come on, Maine. You can take a joke. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. We'll see you right back here tomorrow night, 10 o'clock Eastern on Banfield.